Saheb Shihab. On saxophone, leading and conducting the Danish radio jazz group with something called Dida, that was recorded in 1965. He was born Edmund Gregory and began performing professionally at the age of 13, changed his name when he converted to Islam early in the 1940s, and performed both on his own and with many of the biggest bands and artists of the bebop era. Saheb Shihab died in 1989 at the age of 64. Try to get conversant with his music. It really is extraordinary. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yutrice Lead. It is Thursday, January the 23rd. An independent federal privacy watchdog, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, has concluded that the National Security Agency's program to collect bulk phone call records has provided only minimal benefits in counterterrorism efforts, is illegal, and should be shut down. The findings represent the first major public statement by the board, which Congress made an independent agency in 2007 and only recently became fully operational. It's not clear whether President Obama will accept the board's recommendations, but its findings nevertheless could be used as leverage in federal lawsuits against NSA spying. Meanwhile, the government has accused its largest security background check contractor of defrauding it of millions of dollars, by filing more than 660,000 flawed background investigations. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the Justice Department made the claims in a 25-page civil complaint that joined a whistleblower's lawsuit against U.S. Investigations Services, LLC, in U.S. District Court in Alabama. USIS, as the firm is called, was the firm that conducted background checks on NSA leaker Edward Snowden, as well as Aaron Alexis, a defense contractor who fatally shot 12 people before killing himself at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. last September. Today we'll be discussing new developments in the Detroit bankruptcy saga, and we'll be talking about the effort by the governor to now import a population while he continues to ignore the population already there. That's in the second half of our program. But first, we want to talk about the efforts on the medical and legal front to curb the devastating impact of a cholera outbreak in Haiti that has been linked to UN peacekeeping forces stationed in the country since the massive 7.0 magnitude earthquake 4 years ago. Joining me is Dr. Jean-Ford Figaro, a specialist in healthcare emergency management and public health disasters. Since 2010, he has been a spokesman for cholera victims in Haiti and has urged the United Nations to take responsibility. He joins us now from Boston. Thank you, Dr. Figaro, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a truly pleasure for me to be at your show and also to speak with your audience about this ongoing issue of cholera in Haiti. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Not at all. Could you tell me, and tell us, I should say, tell us about the magnitude of the cholera outbreak and what the implications are from your perspective as a public health official?
Well, first of all, we did not have cholera in Haiti for the past 100 years. Cholera, it's really a new disease for all Haitian doctors, doctors who are practicing in Haiti. And it was until October 2010 with the Nepalese peacekeeping force, and Mirbalet, and all the scientific evidence led the lack of sanitation with the introduction for the first time of cholera in Haiti. Since then, we have lost over 8,000 lives that's I can say that more than 8,000 of my Asian brothers and sisters have contracted and died from cholera. And as we're speaking, more than 700,000 people have been infected, and more than 1,100 people every month in Haiti have been infected by cholera. And from a public health perspective, we can say that we're going to have cholera for many years in Haiti, because since the outbreak, and the UN has not taken any responsibility for what they've done, and we don't have the money to spend on clean water, sanitation, hygiene, and other health infrastructure. And the expert have predicted that if we don't do nothing, it's not only is going to be for Haiti, but also we have seen the same strength in Cuba, in Mexico, Dominican Republic, and right now we can say like the Asian cholera is a threat for the continent and for all the country surrounding. That's why I think it is important, urgent, to take care of what is happening right now in Haiti. And we are counting in the UN to come and help the Haitian government to cope with the effect of this disastrous disease right now, which is the cholera in Haiti.
Well, in fact, just yesterday, a special envoy to the United Nations said exactly what you just said, that the situation has reached a point now where cholera within Haiti would spread to other countries and really begin a chain reaction that would be very hard to contain. Do you know whether that plea by a UN envoy makes it even more important? Does it encourage a response by the UN, or is the UN still being reluctant to become involved?
I was stunned. I was surprised by the declaration of the UN envoy, Mr. Medrano, Pedro Medrano. And I think this is hypocrisy, because if we don't do nothing, but who is going to act? And we know that the UN is responsible for the cholera outbreak in Haiti by a criminal negligence, by violating all the protocol. When I'm talking about protocol, I'm talking about prophylactic protocol, pre-screening of peacekeeping soldiers coming in Haiti. And we have seen by the epidemiological data, by what the scientific community have said, that the UN, they are responsible. And right now, what I was expecting from Mr. Medrano to say, it was like, we are going to find the money to help the Haitian people. The UN is committed this year to fund the eradication plan, which is going to cost $2.2 billion of dollars to eradicate cholera in Haiti. I was expecting the UN envoy to say, like, we're going to help the Haitian government. We're going to open the cholera treatment center, who have been closed. We're going to help. And with this declaration, I don't see where is the UN is supporting or the UN is trying to help this disaster is happening right now in Haiti. And
so Dr.
So
Figaro,
the UN, yes.
I'm trying. So in this situation, then, where is help, if any, where is help coming from?
The help was supposed to come from the UN because they are responsible for that. But right now, we have seen most of the cholera treatment center close. And the Haitian government doesn't really have the necessary funds to cope with the demand. And it's only 1% of the money. And we're talking about like $20 million by the World Bank. But from the UN, it's what now nothing. We have only 1% of the money. And we, as the public health guy, I would like to see a monitoring and prevention to help people how to prevent from contracting this bacteria. It's a deadly bacteria. And to open clinics, to open more health centers. But unfortunately, we don't see anything like this from the UN, from any other organization. And the victims, now the Haitian people, they kind of really, it's only praying God that they don't contract cholera, but any help. And this is why we in the diaspora, we are asking the UN, and right now we just we are going to send a letter to Secretary Kerry to because we like 3 months ago we sued the UN because they really don't want to sit down with the victims, to sit down with the lawyers, and to find an issue, to find a way to help the Haitian people. And we have to go to a court of law. And right now we are asking the State Department to side with the victims, to side with the Haitian people, so that the UN can take responsibility for what they've done to the Haitian people.
Well, in this regard, we have Brian Concannon, who is the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. And Brian, thank you for being with us today. And we're going to be talking about a lawsuit that you are spearheading. Could you give us an idea of what it is and what you are expecting?
Sure. First of all, it's very good to be with you, and thanks for covering this issue. We initially filed a claim with the UN's own internal proceedings because that's our understanding under the law. That's what we were required to do, and was to give the UN an opportunity to take responsibility for bringing cholera to Haiti. The UN refused to consider our application, and so we had no other choice other than to file a lawsuit in a national court, and we filed it in the U.S. federal court in New York in October. And we're asking for two things. We're asking for the court to order the UN to put in the water and sanitation systems that are needed to stop the cholera epidemic. The world has a lot of experience. For 150 years, we've been fighting cholera epidemics, and what you always need to do is to put in water and sanitation. So we're asking the UN to do that. And the second thing is we're asking the UN to compensate the victims. There's, as Dr. Figaro knows well, there's children who've lost their parents, and they've had to drop out of school because they've lost their parents' income, and they're really being condemned to generational poverty because they won't be able to learn their way out of poverty. There's families who've lost everything they had, and we're asking the UN to compensate people for their losses, which is actually not legally controversial. There's no question. The UN has admitted over and over again in treaties, in legal opinions, in General Assembly resolutions that it has an obligation to compensate people harmed by its activities. In this particular case, it's claiming an exception that has no basis in the law. It's basically saying, try to sue us, you can't sue us, so we're going to be above the law.
Well, this is an interesting scenario because who, therefore, is the UN compelled to obey? I mean, the Centers for Disease Control did, in fact, verify that it was the cholera strain was, in fact, connected to the Nepalese peacekeepers. And so it's not just a contrivance, it's not just a guess. It has been scientifically declared that this, in fact, has been the cause. Therefore, these peacekeeping forces under the direction of the United Nations ultimately is responsible. But what is the legal counter-argument that the UN is making? Why is it refusing to legally accept blame?
Well, the UN's substantive legal position, what they say is why they're not. They don't have to accept blame. They don't even say they don't need to accept blame because they actually can't defend that position. What they do is they take more of a technical procedural argument. They say, you can't even sue us. We're immune from service. And so to get to your question about who does the UN answer to, that's what's being resolved in this case. The UN's position is it doesn't answer to anybody, that it's above the law. Our position is that this is a world where laws matter, where international treaties matter, where legal opinions matter, and that the UN is going to be held to it. And if it will not step forward and take responsibility itself, then courts should step up and make it take that responsibility.
What about, has the suit also targeted the Nepalese government?
No, it hasn't, for a couple of reasons. First of all, our reading of the facts is that this was not a primary responsibility of the Nepalese government, that when the soldiers were brought to Haiti without being screened for cholera, that is, from what we can tell, in full conformity with UN medical protocols, that they actually don't, even though it's been raised within the UN many times that you do have this risk of bringing infectious diseases over, there is no protocol that peacekeeper and troops be screened or be treated. And that was one that the experts panel now 2.5 years ago, the UN experts panel, made a recommendation that troops be screened or just be given a simple course of antibiotics. The UN has refused to implement that. The second reason is that we think that the sewage system in question at the Nepalese base, that it was dumping the sewage directly into the river, that was under the ultimate authority of the MINUSTAH, the UN missions engineering department, and that it was the engineering department's responsibility to make sure that the sewage system worked in a way that wasn't causing a deathly threat to the Haitian people. So it really is the UN's fault, not the Nepalese government's fault.
I'm still unclear about the jurisdiction of the suit, the origination and the jurisdiction of the suit being federal, U.S. federal. How does that relate to an international question?
Well, first of all, the UN is in New York. We filed in New York in part because the defendant is in New York. A lot of the decisions, especially the decisions about medical protocols, and the ultimate supervision was done from New York. Also, many of our plaintiffs are also from New York. We've got Haitian-American people who themselves contracted cholera or had family members back in Haiti who contracted cholera. There's an argument to be made that Haiti would be a better venue for the case. The problems with Haiti are, first of all, that we're concerned the UN would just ignore a Haitian court judgment in a way that would be much harder for a federal court. And the federal court is a very good system. I mean, it tries cases seriously. If we can get into court, it will give us the full opportunity to present our evidence, and it gives full compensation to people who establish that they're entitled to it. And we're also looking at cases, filing cases in European courts with people from European countries such as France and Belgium and Holland, who have a connection to Haiti, as some of our U.S.-based plaintiffs do.
Does the International Court have any jurisdiction here or any part in this legal matter?
No. Well, first of all, it doesn't have jurisdiction over the UN in this type of suit. And second, we can't, the International Court of Justice, only states can file claims. And one of the kind of the weird dynamics of this case is that the Haitian government has not come out in favor of justice for its citizens. And that has a lot to do with the balance of power in Haiti with the peacekeeping force. As in the case of any country that has a peacekeeping force, it's typically not a country that has a huge amount of central government authority. And so far the Haitian government, although you know, they know the facts of this case, they have not felt that they could step up and demand justice from the UN. And so it's unlikely that the Haitian government would take the case to an international court.
Considering that former President Bill Clinton had a pretty predominant role in the aftermath of the earthquake and had committed to helping Haiti, would Bill Clinton's influence in any way help this lawsuit?
We hope so. You know, President Clinton was probably the first person associated with the UN to concede that the UN was responsible. Back in early 2012, he spoke to reporters and he said, yes, the peacekeeping troops were the proximate cause. Besides that, we don't know what else he's done. Certainly he does have a role because of his role in Haiti, because of who he is. And also it's important to remember that the United States is the leading contributor to MINUSTA. And so we have a lot of influence within the UN. And if the U.S. government wants a just response to the cholera epidemic to happen, that just response will happen. We have the leverage with the United Nations to make sure that the victims get justice.
So the suit has been filed. What's next?
Well, what's happening right now is we're trying to sue the UN. We're trying to serve the UN. So typically you file a lawsuit, you send it to the court. Next thing you do is you give it to the adverse parties. The UN is refusing to accept service, so we're struggling with that, but we're confident that fairly soon we'll be able to affect service. But right now, the UN's position is that it's above the law and that it will take any measure it can to avoid justice. So it's been a bit of a struggle to actually serve them. Once we do serve them, then it goes into. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. You finish, please.
Once we do serve the UN, then it goes into, we expect that the UN will contest jurisdiction. The UN will say that it's immune and that we can't sue it anywhere. And then there will be a fight in both the district court and probably also an appeals court over that. And we'll be mostly probably for the next few months fighting about the issue of UN immunity before we get to the substance. That if we win on the immunity count, then it will go to a trial on the substance of the case.
Dr. Figaro has painted a very bleak picture of what is happening now. What can be done legally to get immediate assistance, even on purely humanitarian grounds, let alone the legal issues? But what could be done right now to compel a response by the United Nations, considering that it has so many international conventions on what people are, how states are supposed to respond in a catastrophe like this?
Legally nothing can be done to compel the UN to act right now. Unfortunately, lawsuits are typically fairly long-range tools, and the best we can do is this is a long, probably drawn-out fight because the UN is going to continue to draw it out as long as it can. But politically, there are certainly much quicker ways. And part of that happening is journalists like you covering this story. But if the U.S. government feels enough political pressure and feels that it's in U.S. interest to force the UN to respond better, then that certainly will happen. The UN has come up with this plan. It's called the Cholera-Free Hispaniola Initiative that would, if it was fully funded, it would largely solve the problem. It's a plan for putting in infrastructure for health care. But what it's done is it's kind of got the shell of a plan that says it's a good idea, but it is not funded. And so it's really a question now of forcing the UN to to adequately fund the solution that it has in principle agreed to, but it just hasn't actually done what's necessary to come up with the funding.
So, Dr. Figaro, what happens now with the awesome task that you and others are facing in trying to deliver some kind of help to cope with this catastrophe?
I would like to thank Brian and the Institute for Justice for the great job they are doing representing the victim in the case. But in the ground in Haiti, since the rainy season is approaching, and that's why you you mentioned at the beginning that the UN envoy is urging for help before the rivers, before the waters started contaminated by the bacteria. But we think that the UN should go and apologize to the Haitian people. And we think also that in order to resolve, to eradicate cholera, we have to give clean water to the Haitian people. And to do that, we need like $400 million to start with the water. And actually, we don't have the money. And that's why the UN envoy was saying, like, maybe we're going to see double of the people who are dying right now. And we think this is a violation of the human right. This is a violation of the Haitian right, and this is criminal. And we as people, we as the diaspora, the only thing that we can continue to do is the mobilization, and it's asking our elected official, it's asking other institutions to really help us, because if not, we're going to see in 2-3 years the number double, about like patient people dying and contracting the disease. We really need the UN to come and really help and do what they're supposed to do, because they are responsible, because they are the institution who really brought for the first time cholera in Haiti, and because of that, we need the help. And they have to do it. They have to take responsibility for all the cholera victims and Haiti, and also for the impact in the economy and the public health, and also the impact that we as diaspora, when we send money to our families, instead of this money buying food or other things, and then they have to take this money and go into the clinic buying a medication. And we think like the burden of impact that the cholera is having in our country, it's something that we take it beyond reasonable, and that's why we're asking the UN to take this seriously for what they have done to our country.
Well, we will continue following the story. It's a great tragedy on top of the tragedy 4 years ago. So, Dr. Figaro, thank you so much. Brian Concannon, thank you so much. We will come back to you again to update us on what is going on in terms of this awful, awful situation. Thank you so much, though, for being with us today and sharing the information that you have, so people know that there is this disaster that is being aided and abetted by the UN, and the UN is resisting its responsibility to respond appropriately. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Well, thank you for covering this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. We'll go next to Detroit, but after this little bit of Sahib Shihab. Thank you. that is Sahib Tuha with the Danish Radio Jazz Group with a nifty little tune called Dida. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.fm. I'm Utrice Lead. And we go now to Detroit, where the governor has a plan to import a brand new population while he ignores the population already there. Joining us, of course, is our regular commentator and analyst of things going on in Detroit, Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, a Detroit organizer for the Workers' World Party. Hello, hello, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay. You're about to get a new population, it seems. The governor is in the population replenishing business.
Yeah, I think there's something he had raised before about encouraging immigrants, but it's only a certain type of immigrant that they're really encouraging. If you read the fine details underneath what they're saying, and they want people who have certain advanced degrees, who have resources, probably business interests to come into the city. He's appealing directly to the federal government, wanting 50,000 work visas, 10,000 per year over the next 5 years. So we'll see what happens, but there has to be opportunity here for people to come and to stay, and that has been the problem for many years in Detroit as well as Michigan, is that a lot of the jobs that people have been employed with have been eliminated. So you want people to come, but at the same time, if you don't really have resources for them, it's going to be problematic. Even today, there's a large Latino population in the southwest section of Detroit. They had been immigrating into the city for well over a decade, and a lot of the neighborhoods in southwest Detroit were being revitalized with small businesses, social organizations were there. There was the advent of low-powered FM radio stations, community newspapers, and so forth, but what we've noticed over the last two or three years is that these businesses, too, have been closing. And it's contributing as a result of a number of factors. Of course, when people lose their homes, and there's a tremendous problem with foreclosure and eviction now in immigrant community, particularly among the Latino, Middle Eastern community. Moratorium Now has been doing work around this for the last 7 years. And that's serious. So a lot of people are being driven out of these communities that they have moved into over the last decade or so. Also, there's a problem with unemployment. And if people have a small business, or if they're trying to maintain a household and they can't find regular work at decent wages, then they're not going to be able to maintain a household either. So, and then, of course, the role of the immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, and their raids under the Obama administration, they've been deported more people than any other period in U.S. history. And they've been very active in the Detroit area. So all of these factors are weighing against you know, certain elements of the immigrant community right now. So I don't see how they're going to bring in new people without resolving some of these existing issues.
Elena Herrada joins us now. She has been with us a couple of times. She is a longtime respected community builder and describes herself today as a school board member in exile. Elena, thanks for joining us. You're on with Abayomi Azikiwe.
Thank you. Hello, dear brother Abayomi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. I recognize your voice immediately.
Yeah, yes, I was just talking about the problems
of ICE,
you know, with
I
the people who have come in the last decade, and now they're being driven out, too, and they want to bring in new people, so...
Yeah.
So, Elena, what is happening at ground level? But first, tell us what's going on with this new title that you have, school board member in exile. Why are you in exile?
We are in exile because we are under an emergency manager. But we on the school board have been under EM since 2009, and I've been on the board since 2010. And the schools are separate from the city of Detroit. We're not in the charter. We're a separate entity. So when they tried to take over the schools and put them under what they call mayoral control, and the people resisted that and fought it back, so they weren't able to do it. It was mainly philanthropic organizations and nonprofits that were trying to push it under mayoral control in order to be able to turn them into charter schools. And we have been able to fight it, but it's been a very, very protracted battle. And I actually wanted to share with you what some of the consequences of being under an emergency manager mean, because now the city is also under an emergency manager. So the school board went first in 2009, and as we say, first they came for the schools, and no one was there. So when they came for the city. Now, there's a very, very specific class-based struggle going on, because Detroit Public Schools is really made up of the people who couldn't leave. So they just left the poorest people there. And anybody, it's long been segregated, but by class, everybody that could leave did. So that's why nobody cared about DPS, and we had the school board meetings that for years nobody even came to them, because we had been stripped of academic power. The first thing they took out was African-centered curriculum, which had been a long fight to get. That was the first thing that went, which, of course, leads to failure when you're talking about a population of black students who do not see themselves reflected in the curriculum, and now not in the classroom either, because we're riddled with Teach for America and all kinds of young white faces that have come to Detroit to save us. So it's been a real, really painful battle. But I do want to talk about what emergency manager means on the ground. And this is what people don't see unless you're in it and dealing with it on a day-to-day basis. It really did restore discrimination in all of its forms, especially in workplace discrimination. Are you with me?
Yes, listen intently.
Okay. One of the main things, and I've been really observing this and reflecting it because I don't see anybody talking about it, because a lot of people don't know. You don't know what it's like to live in a city where the basic structures have been deconstructed. And when you can trash something to the point where everyone believes that it was no good, then it's justified. So this was a corrupt city, and it was incompetent. It was unlivable. Nothing worked. It was really treated like the way you hear the U.S. describe some of the African countries. It was really treated like, you know, the only way you can get anything done is if you can deal with the corruption. But that was a narrative that was, by and large, untrue. But what they did when they took it apart, when they dismantled it, is, you know, black teachers have been removed from the classrooms and replaced by white teachers, and principals are hired without even a job interview. And I'm going to talk here specifically about the Detroit School for the Arts, because the founder of that school actually wrote a book about this, Dr. Denise Cotton. They actually have this probably 27-year-old white male as principal of one of our most prized schools in Detroit, because he was brought in because his wife got a job at University of Michigan, and University of Michigan is one of the principal takeover tools with regard to training the Teach for America students to put them into Detroit public schools. And this is a shout-out, because U of M students are raising hell right now. The black students are raising hell. So they are demanding increased enrollment, better financial aid, better support, and you see a movement coming at U of M like we haven't seen anywhere in a long time. But those students probably don't even know that U of M has been instrumental in basically restoring employment discrimination to the Detroit School of the Arts and some of the places of Detroit Public Schools, where for years and years there was a structure where you apply for a job. If you're qualified, you get in line. It's civil service. That's been disrupted. And the unions, that's been disrupted, so there's no seniority. So what we're really seeing under the emergency manager regime is basically chaos and blatant racial discrimination. And what does it lead to? A complete lack of fairness. It's a complete lack of fairness. It restores white privilege, and it restores incompetency, because you don't have to have any credentials necessarily to get some of these jobs. You just have to be in favor. Wow. On the ground, emergency management restores racism, it restores discrimination, and it destroys the structure that made things fair. And this is what most people don't understand. It's not just taking away our right to vote. It took away the structures that make things fair. And that's what I've really been reflecting on, and I want people to understand. And that's why when you see the people who come here and are able to get the opportunities with the new jobs and everything else, if you're not hooked up with some of the rich people, you don't get anything. So why are we having our students go to school? Why are we having people continue to work toward a goal that they may never reach if they're not part of the new landed gentry? That's the issue here.
Do you see it that way too, Abayomi?
Yes, they started with the public schools about 15 years ago. There was a state takeover over the previous Republican governor, John Ingram. And at the time of the takeover, this was in 1999, the school system had a $93 million surplus. Now, there were problems, of course. I mean, any urban school district is going to have problems, particularly if you have large-scale outsourcing, downsizing, and all of that. But the point is, since they've taken over periodically over the last decade and a half, it's gotten worse. 200 school buildings at least have been closed.
Right. We only have 104 schools left.
Right. It's outrageous. And as Elena says, competent people have been moved out. They're bringing in outside people who know nothing about how to run a school system. And the same thing is true with the city now. The conditions have gotten worse under emergency management. The buses now are deplorable. People are packed in like sardines. It's just a high level of incompetence, and we're paying for it. So it's no solution, this privatization and charterization.
And now
just creating more.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Could you talk a bit about the resistance? Do you see a sense that people are actually becoming more and more involved in taking a stand against this organized opposition to them and their interests?
I want to shout out to Abiyomi and Moratorium Now, and the group that have been the group that Abiyomi belongs to, that I have been a longtime fellow traveler in, has to me been there are other groups, but the work that they're doing on the bankruptcy with Jerry Goldberg as an attorney against Jones Day. So we have these tiny, tiny people with no resources fighting giants like Jones Day. That's a group that Abiyomi's from. That's Moratorium Now. And there's several other alliances, but and the fighting of the foreclosures and the gathering of the Martin Luther King group every year, which gathers activists who aren't really in the mix from all over, to be able to explain some of the things that are going on. The Bill Kellerman and I were arrested for protesting the Jones Day contract, and we go to court next Monday morning, January the 27th in 36th District Court. We're going to court. We demanded a jury trial, and we're hoping that many of the people who are fighting the pension theft and the foreclosures and everything else, the emergency manager, all of the onslaught will come to court with us. And that's, we just want to make that sort of one point of resistance. But there's a lot of different groups that are resisting. Abby only can talk more about that, but I wanted to really give a shout out to Moratorium Now, because they so get what's at stake, and have been doing teach-ins explaining this, and they're both plaintiffs and attorneys on the case of the bankruptcy. So we go into federal court with this group that has documented and resisted every step of the way. And I want to say also that the people from Moratorium Now are the pensioners and City of Detroit workers who have had their wages stolen from them. So this is a very, very deep grassroots, credible group resisting this fight.
In a sense, this narrative that we have been engaging in the past several months, we've been talking about what's going on in Detroit, it seems so surreal. Do you get it? It seems just like a movie plot or something. Do you get a sense of isolation? Are people around the country aware that? Do you get a sense that the awareness is much larger than where you are? That the nation somehow has understood this struggle, and they're seeing the deliberate deconstruction of a city, and in order to reconstruct it in a way that is, quote, suitable, unquote, for desirable people. And do you get a sense that do you feel isolated in your struggle, is really what I'm asking?
Oh, yeah, there's complete media blackout of what's been happening here. Today, Governor Snyder is here in Detroit touring. He shouldn't even be able to come here, but he's touring and pushing an initiative to bring professional immigrants in to take the jobs that corporations want to be able to fill these jobs with. And it's like India, China, different places where they can bring in people and create a new kind of visa. But what it really does is drive down the wages of those professions, because they want them to be filled by people from different countries where their immigration status is tied to that job. There's people here who could take those jobs, and if not, they certainly could be trained for them. But instead, Snyder and the Chamber of Commerce are touting this plan to bring immigrants in, and it's creating incredible resentments, incredible anti-immigrant resentments among the majority African-American population and Chicanos, but Latinos. But what they want is not immigrants like us. They don't want border crossers. They don't want domestic workers. They don't want the landscapers. They want doctors, lawyers. They want the people who are involved in university research, all different kinds of researchers. That's who they want. And they're not investing anything in education in the population here. In fact, they're so divesting in education here that we're just going to be a population of people who wait on the people who can come here.
Really, like the Walking Dead. I mean, Abiyomi, do you feel isolated? I mean, you and Elena are activists. You're involved in doing this kind of work for a while, and to a certain degree, you're prepared for the opposition. But do you get a sense of isolation that other parts of the country are not really responding, probably because they don't know? Or if they do know, they don't particularly care?
Well, yeah, it's a dual situation. On the one hand, there has been a lot of national as well as international publicity about what's going on in Detroit, but most of it is from the perspective of those who are the perpetrators of this disempowerment of people in the city of Detroit. They're trying to make it look like the bankruptcy is a good thing, that emergency management is a good thing, and that their intentions are just to improve city services and to reinvent Detroit and rebuild Detroit and so forth, but that's not the case at all. And the isolation could come in when you're trying to organize the community and rally the community, when the forces that be, the powers that be, are systematically destroying the base under which you're trying to organize, the schools. This is what people traditionally have done, organization, in plants, workplaces, in neighborhoods, in schools, and this is being systematically destroyed by the system, closing the schools, downsizing and tax on teachers and clerical staff and custodians and social workers. And the same is true for municipal employees as well. So it's a struggle on more than one level. On one level, you have to maintain vigilance, to do political education, to do the organizing work and so forth. But at the same time, people are under siege every single day of their lives. They have established blight committees to go around and mainly harass homeowners in areas where income is being lost, where jobs have been lost, where they really don't have money to fix up their homes. So this is designed to drive even more people out of the city. So this is how we have to approach the situation. We have to approach it both from the standpoint of where people are, but at the same time try to advance demands and objectives in regard to where people should be and where the city should be.
Well, on that note, we've come to the end of our program today. I want to thank you for spending this time with us, but more time is needed, and you certainly will be, you know, back with us talking about what the nation is missing by design and by conspiracy, the information that it needs to make sense of what is happening in Detroit at ground level, and the relationship between the consequences of this conspiracy and the people who have no problem just spending hours and hours and hours thinking up of more ways to drive this city down to a point of no return and then refresh it with really real people. So I want to thank you, Elena Herrada. I want to thank you, Abayomi, for being with us today.
Yes.
And of course, we expect to be talking with you again soon. But thank you so much for the work
thank
that you do and for the work that you do. Thank you immensely.
All right.
Thank you. And for giving us here the privilege of your years of experience and of your expertise in community organizing and, of course, your intelligence in analyzing the situation as it is. Thank you so much.
All right. So, thank you.
All right. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay.
So that brings us to the end of our program today. Two really formidable things confronting us. The situation in Haiti is unbelievable, and the response is equally unbelievable. And, of course, the metamorphosis of the city of Detroit continues with a specific goal in mind. And these discussions that we have been having are chapters in the textbook of how governments, at this notion of white supremacy, it just takes off in a macro way and having such incredible impact at ground level. So thank you for being with me today. Coming up next is Mike Fader with Occupied Territory America. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories with you, Therese Lead, on Facebook. I still have to get used to saying these things. But thank you so much. And let's meet again tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on prn.fm.